some point you'll see it. You might not believe it until it's gone.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Trees Reach podcast. My name is Dylan.
I'm Riley.
And I'm Luke.
And as you can see, we're still in our Zoom format, as there are some stricter quarantine operations in play, which is fine. It's been kind of fun to talk over Zoom and do the podcast that way. Today, we're going to be talking about track 4 on our album, Some Night You'll Hear Me Crowing, which is called Hello Conscience. If you are unfamiliar with the song, you ought to go listen to it right now. It's on your streaming service of choice. You can also listen to it for free on our website or on YouTube. Get familiar with the song, then come back. The basic structure of the song is it's piano-driven, and then partway through you have drum and bass come in, and then it modulates from the key of D to the key of E after a very brief piano solo. And things take off with some electric guitar and some exceptionally well-arranged trumpets by Mr. Riley himself.
Shucks.
So we're going to dive right into this, and I'm going to hand the Zoom baton over to Riley to talk about the history of this bad boy.
Cool. Yeah, you just describing the kind of arc of the song made me realize that it's pretty much exactly the same as the last song on the album.
Piano, I think it's probably led. The same as many songs that we write.
Well, but specifically like piano and vocals alone, and then drums and bass come in. And then for the last bit of the song, like other instruments come in and really kind of seal the deal. So yeah, we never claimed that we were diverse songwriters as far as our arrangements go, but I like to think that our songs have a lot of different ingredients going on to keep them varied. But anyway, so Hello Conscience, this song I wrote when I was probably 15. I might have finished it when I was 16, something like that. And I was in a period where I was totally obsessed with Radiohead and Pink Floyd, as I was for most of high school. And so I think that this song's influences can be traced back, to two Radiohead songs in particular. There's one called Nude and one called A Wolf at the Door. And they're both slow 6/8 or 3/4, depending on how you dice it up. They're just slow triple meter grooves, which means they feel very like... And that's all I wanted to hear. I thought that was just the coolest groove possible at the time. I still think it's great, and I love songs that really take off with that type of soaring, like it's like a rock skipping on water. And so I wanted to write a song in that feeling. And I was also really getting into jazz at the time. I was playing guitar in jazz band, and I think I had probably like recently gotten back from a jazz camp at UNI, because I was full of some spicy piano chords. You hear some dominant 7th flat 9s, some minor 11 chords in there, especially in the piano solo. So I just really wanted to flex with some crunchy chords. I should have been practicing my sense of rhythm more than my knowledge of chords, because what you hear in this song is like a after the fact, like a quantized version where I like went into the wave, like the actual audio forms. I was like, oh, that's a little too early. And I grabbed it and moved it a little later, that type of thing. So that the piano did a little bit better of a job of like having a regular sense of pulse. Especially with offbeat hits.
And if you haven't, listener, picked this up already, it's Riley playing the piano on this track, not me.
Yes, yeah. So this is one of only two songs where I did the piano work. But yeah, I I had a bunch of cool jazz chords I wanted to use, and I wanted to write a song that had that rock skipping type of feeling. And I think I did a decent job for being 15. I think that the form of the song, like the spirit of the song, holds up. And I still really like it.
How old are you now?
I'm 23.
16. Oh,
oops.
I'll be 24 in, oh my gosh. I'll be 24 in 4 days.
Wow.
Holy cow, Rick.
I didn't realize my birthday was coming up.
Wow.
Well, by this time, it'll be past Riley's birthday by the time you're listening to this. So you all can say happy belated birthday, Riley.
Thanks. We should do like a Zoom birthday party though. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
True.
Well, in one of the best things I've experienced, I think, during this quarantine, is Zoom calls where people sing happy birthday. it is
by far the
biggest train wreck I could ever imagine. Everybody is not only singing in their own key, but in their own time signature as well, starting at different times.
And then trying to compensate for each other.
Yeah, it almost turns into like a wicked round.
Wow.
So good.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It is so great.
Man, I can't wait.
So yes, we should do that.
Honestly, guys, I can't wait to be sung happy birthday and in the wicked round, as Luke put it. That's beautiful.
I was at a birthday party recently where a bunch of older people said, let's all sing happy birthday. And then someone said, well, wait, will that work on Zoom? And then I started to say no because, and then I said, never mind, because I wanted to hear it. And they did it, and it cracked me up.
Oh, man. It's the little things, right, guys?
It is little things. This is not to make fun of people who don't understand the internet.
No, not at all.
Because you don't think about it. You know, you assume that you're hearing everybody in real time, but you can't do anything in sync with each other.
Because the heart is there, though. And that's always better.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, to get back on track, Dylan and I were having a little bit of a disagreement about the original form of this song, whether or not I wrote it on guitar or piano. And we're talking about something that happened 8 or 9 years ago, so you can imagine why there would be some confusion. But my recollection is that I was really into like learning jazz chords on piano. And so I would have assumed that I would have written it on piano at the time, but Dylan has a different memory. Dylan, what do you recall?
My memory is that you, on at least one occasion, played a show by yourself that was supposed to be a me and you open mic show. But then I had to work at Applebee's because I forgot to request it off. It's happened more than once, folks. I'm recovering. But I remember watching a video of that, of one of those shows that you did by yourself. And I remember that being when you debuted Hello Conscience, and you didn't have all the verses written. I think it was just a 2-verse song. It didn't modulate to another key. And I remember you playing it on guitar, and I kind of thought, oh, this has got like an interesting, what I perceived as a John Mayer chord structure kind of a vibe. Mm-hmm. At the time, that's the first time I heard the song. Now, that being said, I obviously could be remembering it wrong. / You could have written it on piano and just played it on guitar at that show,
right?
And don't remember
it could
that.
Be. I do remember that we played at an open mic. I remember the first time playing it. I thought it was at an open mic where we brought your keyboard and I played keyboard and you played probably guitar or something, and it was.
I do remember doing that. I do remember doing that. Yeah,
but the only thing I remember from that, the one show I remember that I did on my own, was I threw together a song that had, its climax was what is now the climax of Seven Stories, Through the Window, Through the End, and it had a different, like, A and B section, and that was like the C section of the song, and then I later took that song and we wrote a different first part for it. And it became Seven Stories, which we'll talk about in a while. But yeah, so who knows how this song began? I remember playing it on my parents' baby grand piano. And I think, regardless of where I wrote it, I think the piano does a pretty good job. When you play on a guitar, it does sound very John Mayer-y. Like, there's really no way to do it that doesn't sound like it's John Mayer. So, which, I mean, is not a bad thing.
True.
So, yeah, that's all I have to say, really, about the history of this. Oh, well, I will mention that and we'll talk more about the lyrics later, but in that period of my life when I was, you know, like 15 years old writing this song, the first draft of the lyrics were a little more angsty than they are. And it was very much like a teenager writing a song about finding their identity, which we later...
Lame!
We later, like, took the elements of that worked in this... Sorry, I'm going to close my blinds.
I'll forgive you.
That's not any better.
There we go.
Later used the bits of that worked, and then Dylan wrote in things that kind of settled it more to fit in the kind of the narrative of the album.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is I mentioned last time that, you know, the most of the songs on this album are old songs with completely reworked lyrics, and this one is no exception. And also, by way of reminder, I'll kind of keep bringing this up because who knows what people remember with 2 weeks in between, but yeah, by way of reminder, we had done this whole album with a different drummer, and then when Luke joined the band, we decided to re-record the drums and rewrite a lot of the songs. So I remember this song in particular, none of us were happy with any of the ideas that we had come up with for our first round of recording it with our old drummer. And so there were a lot of songs that we could put in front of Luke and say, okay, we want to keep this and this and this and this. We just need to re-record the drum track. And then maybe a few things cropped up around that we improved upon. But this one was almost a whole overhaul, with the exception of the piano track that Riley recorded. And the reason it was an overhaul is because most of it was just way too busy. My bass part was way too busy. I remember the drum part was really busy as well, and the song just didn't find its feel. So I guess, Luke, I want to ask you, being handed this song, what did you want to do differently with it to help sell it a little better?
Yeah, I think the main idea behind what I was doing was allowing more chance for the room to breathe, or more space for the song to breathe. Did I say room to breathe? It doesn't matter.
You did.
Song to breathe. And I think something that I learned from the song is that a slow 6/8 is a very unforgiving measure. Like, it's a very there's so much that can go wrong in the spaces between each downbeat. And 2017 Luke didn't really know that. He was going into the studio for the first time. I had heard myself maybe on like church recordings or something playing drums. It wasn't, I don't know if it was ever really anything in 6/8, but this song was, I think, introduced me to my tendency to probably push the beat a little too hard, especially in the 6/8 time signature. 6/8. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think that that comes across pretty strong in the recording. I think I've repressed a lot of the time that we spent, like a lot of the memories I had recording this song. I've repressed a lot of it because it was just really difficult in the studio recording this one. I remember feeling a general just sense of like, oh, I can't get this right. I learned so much in the studio when we were recording drums for this album, but now I should have just like backed off, let it sit for a day or even just like a couple hours and then come back to it with fresh ears. All that to say, 6/8 is an unforgiving, a slow 6/8 is an unforgiving time measure. And I've come a long way from where I was then to now. Luke,
I think the drums on this song sound phenomenal, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Cool. But thanks, Rick.
it's good to know that you can see improvement over the past few years. But I think that you nailed it, really.
Wow.
I remember it as we simplified this song, it being really, 6/8 being an unforgiving time signature is a good way to put it, because there's just with so much time between boom, ka, mm-hmm. boom. It's, and then especially because the only thing I was doing basically for the whole song is doing octaves on the bass, doom, boom. And so that's hitting once with your kick drum and then once with your snare. And so those got to be locked in. I think when I listen to the groove of this song, for the most part, I'm pretty comfortable with it. But I do, it was even it, like when we started playing it live, and we all played it live a few times, but when we started playing this live after we had recorded it, I could already tell that you and I, Luke, were figuring out, oh, okay, this is how it should feel, which is kind of, this is maybe a good example of the unfortunate phenomenon that can happen when you're writing and recording an album, which is you record the song and then you learn how to play it, which I think is how Bruce Hornsby put it. So I think that, I think the content is there. The groove is there as the song in the song, but I can relate to now years later knowing we could do that way better. But, but I think, I don't know. I think the song holds up and it did what it needed to do. So
do we want to listen to some of those stems, some of the parts? Dive in?
Yeah.
Dive in. Head first, baby.
Head first.
What do you guys want
to... Sailor dive, no hands.
What do you guys want to put on?
Did you guys want to listen to any of the grooves?
Yeah, we could if we want to freak ourselves out a little bit. Yeah.
Okay, so here is where the bass and drums first come in.
I remember this being listening to the old version of this song and hearing how busy I was on bass was kind of a wake-up call when I realized that it was just too much. This was a wake-up call for me realizing that oftentimes a simpler bass part, especially in a studio recording, can sell a groove a lot better. And it's about when you choose to lash out and do some fancier stuff that makes it a little bit more impactful. So this is this song is an early example of me, I think, actually finding my groove as a studio player, which is kind of cool.
Nice.
Riley, I remember, so at the end of this song, we had a lot of trouble trying to figure out how to really bring it to its full stature, I think there were a few different options. I think at one point we were talking about trying to get some singers together and do like a choir climax at the end. We didn't get far with it.
Yeah, we talked about that. That was after my original idea was to write, I wrote a string trio, or at least three, maybe there might've been four parts, but strings that were doing like these like duplet rhythms that were kind mm-hmm. of moving past each other like this. And we never had, well, this was before we got Hollywood strings, which is what we use for the other strings. And so while that was on the table, we were going to maybe organize some people we knew through school to record it, but it never came together because that was going to be recorded while we did the Some Night Symphony, which we'll talk about later.
Oh, yeah.
So we never did that. I think I tried various guitar approaches, and nothing was really working. So then I remember laying in bed one morning, I woke up and I was thinking about this song. I was like, man, what am I going to do? And I just started writing in my head a guitar part that would like build the chords, but also harmonize with the melody at the same time. And I'm really happy with what I came up with. It's one of the guitar parts on the album that I'm particularly proud of. So we could listen to that if we want.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear just the guitar or the guitar and the vocal to like hear better how it harmonizes.
Yeah, let's do that.
Mm. Yeah.
These are what we call stems. So they're the original audio files and they have nothing done to them. So they're going to sound pretty stark. But you'll get the idea. Stark, as in Tony Stark.
Right.
Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Yep. My favorite DC superhero. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see how this sounds. Yeah, so it's mainly the first half there where the harmonization is happening.
It's a great part. Were you using the Gretsch Country Gentleman on that?
That was the Gentleman for sure.
Shout out Russ.
Shout out Russ.
Thank you, Russ. Sir.
Yep.
Yeah. So.
And then. Yep. Sorry, did you have anything more to say about that?
Not really. No.
I want to also listen to the trumpets that come in at the end there. That's our boy John Fuller, who played at the end of Lover Lover. Yeah. And that was super, super good. I love this part.
Yeah, I'll put that with the piano maybe.
Yeah.
John is so good
at tracking over himself. I think something I was worried about with layering real instruments and it was only one person is that it would sound a little bit robotic. I feel like I've listened to albums before where I can tell that it's just one violin player layered over and over again, and it kind of takes me out of the feeling. But John, something about the way he plays, it doesn't feel that way at all. It sounds so natural for him to harmonize with himself.
Yeah, he's a great player. Rick, those are great parts.
Those are really good parts. Thanks. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold on, I might I was talking about crunchy chords earlier.
Yeah.
So I want to just see if I can find
crunch, Rick.
I do like a chromatic walk down that lands on what's called a minor 11th chord, which is like, it's like a minor chord, which is like a sad sounding chord in simplest terms, but has a bunch of extensions on top of it, which are notes that just keep extending up the triad. I really like the voicing of the chord that I used. And I just want a little spotlight. Let's see if it's here.
One tarnation. Oh,
that chord. Yeah.
Wow.
Nice little crunch there.
That's Captain Crunch. He's calling you Captain Crunch.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what the voicing I did was, but I really like that part. It's kind of fun.
That's a good part. One interesting thing that I want to mention before we move on to our next bit here is that this is the if we're keeping kind of a tally of the all the different pianos we used for this album, this is the this is a one of a kind piano on this album, much like the Steinway in Self-Absorbed Life. This was also recorded at Kirkwood Community College, but it was recorded in the band room. I don't remember what brand the piano was. It might have just been a Yamaha or a Kawai or something. I don't remember.
Yeah.
But it was a pretty good piano, and we had at least one, maybe two sessions where we were recording pianos for the album with this, and this was another period kind of early on in the recording where we said, yes, this is going to be the piano for the album. We're going to do everything with this piano.
Yeah, this was in 2014.
Wow.
winter.
And so we brought in a task, is it a Tascam Porta Studio, which is basically your one-stop shop. It's a portable soundboard where the files get recorded directly onto the soundboard itself and you export onto a CD.
Yeah.
It's like some prime 2005 technology.
Yeah.
And so we hauled that thing out to Kirkwood and had our friends, Evan Stock from the Evan Stock Band and his drummer Drake. I don't know his last name. Unfortunately, sorry, Drake, I don't know your last name, but they engineered this whole session of us recording these pianos. And, this is the only one we ended up using. Was Riley playing this song.
Is it because the other ones got deleted on accident? Do you think?
I think we accidentally deleted the other ones on accident. It's one of those systems where you have to like hold some other button while you're turning it off in order for your data to save properly. And so a lot of it got corrupted. I might be about to say what you're about to say, which is that you can hear through the mic cables we used, because they're like unprotected cables or whatever you call them, it was picking up radio signal from the jazz station that runs out of Kirkwood Jazz, KCCK. Yeah. And you can hear it very faintly running throughout the entire piano track, which is fun.
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can hear it. Yeah. Yeah, I can't hear, but if you guys can hear it, then that should
be okay. I can hear it quite clearly. If you're listening, just crank that part as loud as you can, and there's some, you can hear what sounds like a saxophone and elements of a drum kit coming through. I have no idea what song it is. We'll probably get copyright infringement.
No. Please. So the other thing I was going to mention was that piano was in the band room, like you said, but that's also the room where we all – at one point or another took music theory classes with Beth Zamzow. So we need a huge shout out to Beth, since a majority of the know-how that we have for how to arrange things like strings, how to do part writing for various instruments, as well as music history things that we take with us as in our approach to music. Beth was a huge influence. And we spent a lot of hours, or at least I know Dylan and I spent a lot of hours in that room, grinding out some music theory. So,
yeah,
I feel like we need to give Joe Perea a shout out too.
Oh, yeah,
this is true.
Yes,
yeah, Joe Perea
was our jazz band director at Kirkwood when we were all three in jazz band together. And so I know that like a lot of our jazz chops and our improvisational communication comes from being able to be in that jazz band together.
True. Yeah. Yeah. He's a great man.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, I want to segue into how I want to kind of carry the rest of the episode out. We haven't spent a ton of time in these episodes talking about lyrical content, but I think this one is a song that warrants some attention on that. Both just because of the song's history and because of its significance. It's sort of what would you call it? Sort of a flagship moment in the album, or an important crossroads that happens lyrically. So historically speaking, Riley had written this song. There was all these lyrics. And as I've mentioned before, we went back and rewrote a lot of the lyrics, A, for poetic value. Like there were a lot of lyrics that we just kind of grew out of and didn't really like. I know that Riley and I especially went through this big lyrical renaissance. We started listening to bands like Fleet Foxes and Sufjan Stevens, and Frontier Ruckus was a huge one, and later on Dawes, these bands that sort of had their lyrical craft mastered way better than other bands we were listening to at the time. And so we unfortunately our lyrics dated for our taste rather poorly, and so we decided to go back and just try to make those more, just make them better. And then also, yeah, fit them into the narrative we were trying to tell in a more clear way that people could follow. So this song is particularly interesting. I don't remember where I was at in the lyrical rewriting process of the album. It's also worth noting, I think the lyrics for this whole album, said and done, was maybe like 80% me and 20% Riley, somewhere in there, give or take. And so I was doing a lot of just, especially in the home stretch, the last several months recording this album, just busting my butt trying to crank lyrics out. So I think when I got to Hello Conscience, I was in this state where I had rewritten several songs. I was just kind of knocking them out one by one, and trying not to leave and come back, just trying to like stay in this constant grind of getting the lyrics out. And so I think by the time I got to Hello Conscience, I remember being in this weird, like just zen, like transcendent, always seeing the album from a bird's eye view, knowing all the metaphors, how they were supposed to play into each other. And Hello Conscience was a challenge because you can think of the first four tracks on this album as being one big statement of the reality of the character's situation coming in, growing older and not knowing how to interpret his life as it is so far, not knowing how to grow up, even though he knows he's supposed to. Track two being the kind of the display of his everyday mindset, what he thinks about himself, what he thinks about other people. Lover, Lover being this sort of false sense of redemption through someone else, a very conditional love. And then Hello Conscience is aptly named because anytime Riley comes in singing, which it is Riley singing on this lead on this song, it's sort of this, it's more of an omnipresent narrative perspective, and it's representing the guy's conscience. He knows all this stuff. He gets that maybe he shouldn't be doing some of the things he's doing, or letting himself go off on thought trails that he lets himself go off on. And so Hello Conscience is this introduction to this kind of more woke side of his brain or whatever that is informing and giving moral quality to everything that he's saying and doing in ways that he's feeling. And so I won't go all the way through the lyrics. Are there lyrics on our website? Can people, they're at least on, you can look them up. They should be on Genius.
They are on Genius, and I think they are on our website, yes.
Yeah. So you can, I would encourage you to go read through the lyrics. I think this song is easy to overlook because it's not the most colorful song on the album. It's kind of straightforward in a lot of ways, but lyrically it's worth just poring over. There are a few things I want to mention though. I'll try to do this as concisely as possible. I think that I remember Riley and I talking a lot about how we wanted songs on this album to be prophetic, or basically just foreshadowing things that'll happen later on in the album. And that happens a lot throughout this song. So one thing that happens is this song asks a question that Timeless, which we'll get to way later, ends up answering, where, you know, the conscience is basically asking the guy, what is it that you're looking for and what is going to be the result of that? And at one point, one of the choruses, so to speak, he goes, is it promise? Is it price? A dream or a lie? In the feeling the night expanse gives you that you cannot quell. Saying, what is it that you're expecting to find out there? And in Timeless, that question is answered by the guy saying, it's not a dream, promise, or lie. Meaning that it's price. There's some sort of price to be paid for being aware of the universe, being aware of how you fit into that. There's a lot I could go into about that, but I won't. I'll move on. Of course, you know, there's significance in the track listing. You see Hello Conscience, and then way later on disc 2, you see Hello Again Conscience. Hello Conscience starts this sort of chain reaction where we're aware of the guy's moral knowledge. So the last thing that the song says, that Riley says, is, I will stay for as long as you want me. As long as you know we can mark this dark hour as the evening that your shadow fell. He's saying, I'll stay with you as long as you know the things you're about to go do are wrong. But as soon as you push that out of your head, necessarily that means I have to leave. And so his conscience is this thing that is loosely but slowly decaying thing grounding him to reality. So everything you hear up before the song Crowds and Loud Noises, which is track 1 on disc 2, his conscience is there kind of informing what he's thinking and kind of creating that tension. But Crowds and Loud Noises, and we'll talk about this in more detail later, is the moment where he says, you know what? I'm just going to do what I want to do and not care what other people think. And from that point on, he's operating outside of his conscience until Hello Again Conscience, when that voice returns and he kind of suffers the consequences for it. So the it is a really...
Crowds should be called Goodbye Conscience.
So Crowds and Loud Noises should be called Goodbye Conscience, at least parenthetically. I'm checking my notes here to see what else I want to say.
There was originally, or at some point along the way, I wrote another verse of Hello Conscience initially recorded to be a tag at the end of Crowds. But I just wasn't a big fan of it. I thought it was kind of like a, not very necessary, and it didn't add to the song.
Yeah, it seemed like maybe it was drawing undue attention to a certain theme that maybe shouldn't have been there. Here's an interesting thing too. When the lyrics were being rewritten, it was often a total overhaul. You know, we didn't keep anything original, but Riley had this whole thing written out with some really great lyrical moments that I thought were worth keeping, like it opening up with, have you lost all your spirit, is a Riley line, but then, and do you not live past the reach of your arm, is a me line, because you are waiting for something but you are not willing to go that far, is a Riley line, as you sit, I'm assuming you can feel something looming, is a me line. So this song is so like such a weird Frankenstein, taking some principles that Riley wrote about and turning them into a song that could fit better with the narrative. And I love one of Riley's lines is, you are broken and you are a token of what you want more. And I think that is such a good way. Every time I hear, well, this whole song, honestly, lyrically, I think is one of the best ones on the album. But that whole last verse, tell me, why are you reaching for God knows what you think is worth reaching for? yes, I guess you are broken and you are a token of what you want more, is such a great way to sum up the first four tracks of the album before we kind of hit this now little boom. Next arc is beginning to happen, which is what we'll get into next time in Wake Up, She Cried.
Yeah.
So yeah, I like hearing this song in the context of it's setting up the whole conflict of the album. Right now we just know about a guy. This is the moment where we say, okay, there's clearly some stewing tension here. And to be more clear, the tension is between essentially escapism, which is what the whole album is about, more or less, and facing the music and growing up. And
yeah, the album is a coming of age story in that few words.
Yeah. So you get, you know, the conscience saying, if you ask, I'll give you an answer that may do you well, but there's some comfort blooming in the warmth that your room brings, which inclines you to blindness about what's been pressing your head for so long. So it sets up the whole thing and sets up some questions that are answered later on in the album. And then at the very end of the song sets up the idea of the shadow. We can mark this dark hour as the evening that your shadow fell, which then finds its place in Sun Chasers with, though the light may strike you blind, to cast your shadow far behind, where that whole weight above him and kind of like always ahead of him, before him and following him is laid to rest and redeemed.
It also sets up the room metaphor, which we then use room and window as like the barrier between the escapism and the opposite of that, which is like a big theme in Timeless as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's in keeping step with the Peter Pan aesthetic of,
right, of course,
of escaping out the window into a realm of dreams. And yeah, so there's a lot there, and we'll unpack that more later. And I'm sorry if you're bored by lyrical exegesis, but I thought this would be the appropriate time to start talking about some of those big plot points. So that's all I got on that.
Cool. Well, was there anything else on the list, on the agenda for this song?
I don't think so.
I think that's a good place to put a fork in her.
Yeah. All right. There's one last thing I would mention, though. If we're going to talk about things that we like versus things that we would do differently.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Something that I've noticed about this song is that I, even when I'm listening to it, even though I know that I like the song and I know how, like, that it gets to be such a party at the end, I'll often skip it once it starts playing. And I'm like, wait, why do I do that? Like, I know that I like this song. And I think that, well, for one thing, the mix is too quiet at the beginning. We didn't like compensate the piano and vocal volume to be kind of more close to what it is once the full band comes in. And so when the song starts, it's like, it's kind of too quiet. It's not like fully woken up. If I were to mix the song today, I would make it more even so that as soon as you put the song on, it's already commanding your attention. And then intertwined with that, I think something that I would want to hear is something in the arrangement that kind of hints at or foreshadows that the song gets to be a party at the end. Like, it's not just like, oh, sad piano song, you know what I mean? Because right. People aren't often in the mood to listen to 5 minutes of sad piano music. Like, you know, I'm in the mood for that more often than most people, I would say, but I still am not in the mood for that all the time. And so I feel like I would guess that people skip this song because of that. And I wonder if there's like a lot of listeners who don't know that this song has like a pretty cool ending, just because they haven't gotten through it. And I wouldn't blame them for not getting through it. So that's what I would change.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would encourage listeners, if you haven't really paid much attention to this song, it's easy to overlook for the reasons that Riley just mentioned, but there's a lot going on there. And so yeah, I'd encourage you to listen to it as if you've never listened to it before. Riley, I know that something specific we've mentioned that we would do differently, specifically to let the listener know that there's more to come, is maybe throw in those trumpets a little bit earlier, but have them be using a Harmon mute or something, just throw them way in the background and just kind of whisper some phrases in between vocal lines. Because I think it is missing, it feels too restful. It's missing a sense of anticipation, like, okay, what's going to come next? It feels a little bit like the song is just kind of happening, like, and then this happens.
Yeah, it'd be nice to know that there's other people in the room.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. There's other people in the room and they're just not saying anything yet. And then when they do, you're like, oh my.
There's a song called, there's a song by Feist that kind of does that, where it's like really like gritty, close acoustic guitar and vocals, with like a spring reverb on it. Sounds really like kind of fierce. And you can hear like chains clinking in the background.
What?
Oh. The first half of the song. And then the song explodes into like big unison vocals, like really distorted, singing this really awesome melody with these great lyrics, and it just hits so hard. And you know, right when you put the song on, like, wait, what's going on? Like, there's a lot of people here and it's really quiet. So like, what's gonna happen? So yeah, that is what we should do next time we write a song and it's really boring for the first minute.
Nice.
One thing something that I like about, though, what we've already talked about, I love this guitar part. It's one of my favorite guitar parts on the album. And I love the brass, that horn writing is so good, Riley, and performance is great. What about you, Luke?
Yeah, that horn part is hot. So I already talked about kind of what, I mean, the difficulty of 6/8, but, I would have done something different with the mix, the drum mix, knowing we were going to be having almost like, I mean, it's a Dixieland kind of a trumpet feel. So I would want something that feels, I think the kit that I recorded on was a pretty big sized, like diameter kit. There were pretty much two kits that I used on this one, my Ludwig one, and this old Rogers kit. That funny story, I think Travis or one of our friends made an Instagram account of pretending to be this Rogers kit after I had posted a photo of it.
I don't remember that.
Oh my gosh. Oh, my phone is right in front of me. I'm pretty sure the account still exists. but I remember posting a photo of it on my Instagram, and then I think shortly after that posting another photo of my Ludwig kit, and then whoever had that Instagram account commented as if they were jealous as the Rogers kit. Anyway, I think I was using that Rogers kit that had some like deeper, bigger sizes on it, and I don't think that was the right move for that song. And I don't quite know how I would mix it now to make it more of a, like to emphasize those horns, but I would like something to fall in the same sphere as that a little bit better than it does in the recording. But those horn parts were recorded when we were recording drums. So what can you do?
Hey, can I end the episode with something funny I just noticed?
Yeah,
so I'm sitting here right in front of my Nord Electro 5D, and written on my Nord, oh my goodness, this perspective is so weird. I think this is all mirror imaged, so you won't be able to read it, but this is all the lyrics for Hello Conscience, because while we were briefly, we only played the song live a few times, and I think just because it never quite fit or never added much to our live set. If you want to hear it more, let us know. But this was right after I rewrote reworked Riley's lyrics. And so, and Riley couldn't remember them. And so I wrote them.
There's
out.
A lot of them.
There's a lot of lyrics and a lot of things that are kind of slightly similar, and you can never remember, okay, this is the chorus where I do this one, and that's the chorus where I do that one.
Yeah.
So I wrote out all the lyrics for Riley to look at while he was playing the piano live for this one. And I just never took it off because I like having it there. This was 2017 or so.
Yeah. Dylan's handwriting is good enough that you can just leave it on things to improve their aesthetic.
That's true.
I cannot say that for myself. Luke, I don't remember what your handwriting looks like, but I don't think it's very good.
No, my handwriting is fine. It's just not aesthetically as pleasing as Dylan's, okay? So
that's fine.
Don't insult me again.
Yeah, Dylan might sort of side hustle doing calligraphy for people.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go, Dylan.
Good idea.
I just kind of have one vibe. It looks a little bit like pirate cursive or something. I don't know how to describe it.
That's your brand, dude. Pirate cursive.
Yeah, dude. Start an Etsy account.
Pirate cursive.
Yeah, if you need more money during this quarantine, just make a bunch of like thank you, get well, happy bar mitzvah kind of cards.
Happy pirate themed bar mitzvah.
Yes.
Oh man, this has been a disaster. Guys, I really look forward to all of you joining us next time for what is by far the most enigmatic Trees Reach song, Wake Up, She Cried. Peter Pan has come and he is to teach us to fly. I can't wait to talk about that one. So tune in next time. And until then, wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
Yes, I guess you are broken. As long.